Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down and having a chat to Joe Stevens. Now Joe is one of my lecturers at university and she has a really great experience with her paramedic profession as well as some nursing. She's also done a PhD, so we will have a chat to her today about all of that. So Joe, would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. Well, I think your introduction was pretty good, but yeah, Joe Stevens, and I've been working at QT for 10 years. And before that, I was working with the Queensland Ambulance Service. And before that, I've worked on some nursing. So I've had quite an eclectic kind of career and done lots of different things.
Absolutely. And how did you start your career? Did you start out as a paramedic or did you start out as a nurse? How was it?
Yeah, well, I left school in the 80s and believe it or not, you couldn't be a paramedic and be a female. When I left high school. So I didn't quite realise that until sort of grade 12 came along. So I was really disappointed. And then I started noticing ambulances going past and all the males were in there. So I did think that was really unfair, but, you know, we didn't kind of question things too much back then. Well, I didn't anyway. And so I started the nursing program at the Royal Brisbane Hospital in 1987. And it was a very different kind of nursing experience to what you would have now. And I did like it, but then I kind of didn't for a while. So I left and did some other things. And then a few years later came back and did nursing at university and also was working. I started work as an honorary paramedic, which was an unpaid role. It was mainly to see if I liked it or not. And I loved it. The moment I stepped in, I loved it. And so, yeah, I've been working there ever since. And then I applied for the student paramedic program, of which it was incredibly difficult to get in because they'd only take 20 or 25 people per year. It took me three times to get in. And then I ended up, getting a gig. So I started in 1995 was when I first started. And I originally worked primarily in Brisbane, but also worked in Logan and Ipswich areas as well, which was great because the type of work we did was quite different in all those areas. So, yeah, just had me, I loved it. I didn't have kids. My husband also worked for the service at the same time. And so we've worked together actually a lot. And we used to talk about ambulance all the time. We hardly ever talk about it now. So,
did you, I know you've mentioned at university that you've done a bit of rural work as well. Is that what you classify with Ipswich or was it out further?
Oh no, way further. So we ended up having a couple of kids, and when my youngest was 4 months old, we decided I was meant to be on maternity leave. And an opportunity came up for my husband and he applied for the OSC position at Mornington Island. And for those of you that aren't sure where that is, that's in the Gulf of Carpentaria, so it's offshore, offshore from Corumba. So it's in the dip around the Gulf. We wanted to go there. There was a number of things, but primarily because my husband and I were both interested in having some experience in Indigenous communities. We have worked, of course, in metropolitan areas and provided lots of care to people that were Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander in the urban area. But we really wanted to take the opportunity while our kids were tiny to, work and live in a really rural and remote. It was very remote. It's about as remote as you can get. And we just loved it. It was so great. We were only allowed to go there for 2 years. That was sort of how they did things back then. It's quite different now. And I had no intention of working there at all. I was just going to raise my kids and I was doing a Master's of Education. And so that was kind of going to be it. But then they got a bit stuck for nurses because we were living in the area right next to the hospital. So I ended up doing a bit of work as a registered nurse. got to learn and understand the community and felt, you know, really welcomed. And then the other paramedic left because there was only the officer in charge and the paramedic. So I ended up applying and getting that role. So it was great. I just loved it. It's was such a, I really don't know how to describe it. It changed us both as clinicians, as professional people and personally as well. It was, I just grew, as did my husband, so much. It was an amazing experience and something that that I think of very fondly.
Absolutely. And that's definitely very remote. So when I was thinking you were going to say remote, I was thinking Central Queensland, but no, that's very remote. So
yeah, that was just one of the places.
Wow. You know, what are the challenges of working in such a remote area?
Well, if you think of all the bad things, cyclones comes to mind. We had a couple of those. The wet season was huge. The tyranny of distance. So we used to have to order our groceries from Cairns, and it would get road transported in a cold truck to Corumba, and then it would go on a big barge sort of thing from Corumba to Mornington Island. And then sometimes, you know, in the wet season, the cyclone season, that couldn't come. So luckily we had a great big chest freezer, and we would freeze, you know, milk and all that kind of stuff. Because I had little boys, I had to make sure that we had enough of everything. So that was a challenge. And then if you really, you know, if you had a sick family member in Brisbane or wherever your family were, it was really difficult to get from there, because you'd have to fly from Mornington Island, and it had about 6 stops to either Cairns or to Townsville. So that was a bit of a challenge. And also I imagine, like, we never had any issues whatsoever, but if you were someone that liked to go to the theatre and things like that, that just is not possible. But other than that, gosh, you know, financially it was amazing. You can't really tell people just how amazing it is without, you know, going into detail, but we saved so much money. We rented a house out in Brisbane. We had the luxury of working opposite each other. So we had Thursdays was our day together where we worked, and then I would be working all different hours, but mostly it was sort of like 11 a.m. till, you know, did a full day's work, and then I was on call after hours, and most of the work we did was after hours. So we both got to be with our kids a lot. But better than that, we got to be part of the community. So we got, you know, the elders started to trust us. We got asked to come and do some things because the community trusted us. We had great working relationship with the police and the hospital staff. So, you know, you work and play together as well. We ended up, because of our little boys being part of the school, and then the school would invite us in to do some work there. So a lot of the work I did some work with the SES cadets. And I happened to be able to use that in my Masters of Education as well, which ended up giving me an opportunity to work in schools as a registered teacher. So, yeah, there was just so many great things, and we were able to be part of and contribute to the community. And I guess that's, you know, my area of interest in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people stems from before then, but, you know, got cemented. And so it's led me to do some work with the university now. So I'm the academic lead for Indigenous Health for our school for clinical sciences at QUT. And I'm doing some work in Cherbourg as well as a result of all that. So, and then I guess that led us to working in Mount Isa. So I was the clinical support officer there for about a year. My husband worked on road, and then we ended up at Hughenden, which is another small town that supports a grazing community. And we were there for more than a year, and then we ended up having to come back to Brisbane because one of our children needed, you know, extra support. So, which is just one of the saddest days, because as far as leaving, because we just loved that community as well. Came back to Brisbane and did some work, and then went back up to Townsville for a number of years. So I was the regional manager for staff development there, and our team looked after all the Gulf area out to as far west as the borders, you know, Mount Isa and Viduri and all those sorts of places, We went as far north as Innisfail and as far south as Bowen. So lots of supportive rural and remote offices in those areas as well. So it took in places like Julia Creek and Cloncurry and, yeah, all those places, which was great. And because of my role, I used to do a lot of travel, so supporting our, you know, our staff out there. So it's just great. I can't stress enough how amazing it is. So in a place, in those small places, you can be as busy or as quiet as you want to be. And let me tell you, the more that you immerse yourself in the community, the better it is. And we did a lot of work with the rural and remote fire officers. So they're typically people that work in other roles. So they might be a teacher, or they might be groundsman at the hospital. They could be the local electrician or even the pharmacist. And so we would go to their training nights, learn about their stuff. They come and learn about our equipment, and they learn to pull out stretchers and use the locking mechanisms. They learn where all our gear was. You know, if we asked, you know, if it all came push to shove and there was a big car accident or something, they would come and help us and know where all our gear was. So it was like having an extra clever set of hands. So people, and they would drive our ambulance and vice, and the reverse would be true. So when the chips were down, you know, we might help them with their hoses and, you know, make sure they're fed and watered and all that kind of stuff, and be there in case they inhaled smoke or whatever. So, yeah, it was just brilliant. And we used to train together with the nurses and the doctors as well. So pharmacists, just amazing opportunities to learn and be part of an interprofessional team.
Absolutely. It sounds like an incredible experience that you had. And I guess with that, we've talked a bit about it at uni, and I've noticed you tried to instill it in us a little bit, but what are the types of skills or I guess confidence that translated over to when you moved back to the metro sort of city region?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the biggest thing was having confidence in your skills and your knowledge and your ability to think about logistics. So obviously if you're in a metropolitan area, particularly if you're in, you know, where I've worked, Brisbane, you've got Heru available, you've got the CCPs, you've got hospitals nearby, you've got helicopters, all that kind of stuff. A backup crew of any description. You've got hands everywhere. In a rural and remote area, so if, you know, typically if you're in the middle of, you know, outside of Hughenden and truck rolls over or something, you may be lucky enough that you've got an honorary officer that you've trained up who might be the local concreter or something. You might have the rural fire officers that you've helped train. They'll come out if you've got a great relationship with the director of nursing or the doctor, they might come out as well. So, but, you know, you have to pre-plan everything. You have to be thinking right from the get-go when you get the call, how far out it is, what you're likely to need, get those things rolling if you can. You might have to have RFDS because the chopper can't come out that far. So you have to be thinking ahead the whole time. You have to have a good rapport with your comms and be letting them know what you've got. So lots of sit reps, lots of finding out what resources are available, because, for example, the RFDS might be out at a big job, or they might have the plane being repaired. And same with all the other guys, you know, they might be out at a fire or something like that. So you've got to be thinking about your resources all the time. And then when you get to your patient, you need to be very systematic in the way that you assess your patient. You need to be looking around. I mean, we used to use bystanders all the time. So whoever was around, it might be a passing car or, you know, a farmer on his tractor or on a horse or something, you just grab everyone that you can if they're willing and physically able to help you. So it's lots of thinking ahead, lots of logistics, pre-planning, keeping you cool, being able to communicate with everybody. So that means all the people I was just talking about, like your communication center, letting them know really quickly your sit rep ahead of time and what resources you're likely to need. Easier to call them off than not call them and have a delay. And then also being able to relate information to people who are perhaps non-clinicians. So it might be the farmer I was saying who's on horseback that you grab, and you might have to ask him or her to assist you with CPR or grabbing your gear. You have to be very good at being able to relay information. Keeping that person calm as well. And then, of course, the patient, you know, if they're from the local town, is usually going to know how far out they are and will know the circumstances of, you know, the whole, you know, area. And so you're going to have to be quite reassuring but not promise things that you can't deliver. So lots of talking with your person, with your patient, and letting them know how things are going. I guess that's another thing too, is that when you're, you know, working and living in a rural and remote area, for example, if you have a young group of people in the car and there's a car accident, it might be the local, you know, half the local football team are in the vehicle, and word gets around that there's been a rollover and that, you know, a couple of people have died. So that's having those really great communication skills and being able to talk with people about what's actually happened, not delivering promises that you can't keep, talking with the fireys, talking with the police, really, really important kind of skills as well. The other thing I'd say is you have to be really confident and really proficient at your skills, and have to do that sometimes without someone else being around. So you have to be able to prioritise what's really important here. What does this person really need? How far away am I? So, you know, thinking about, for example, your drugs, and thinking about what's most appropriate given how far away you are and that kind of thing. So what's going to be the most appropriate for where you are and what they need. So I would say you just have to practice your skills all the time. So if someone, you know, you probably hear me say it at uni, if you're upside down in a ditch at 2 a.m, cold, you know, winter's night, and it's pouring with rain, no one's going to appreciate you saying, I didn't go to that tutorial, so therefore I don't know how to put that piece of equipment on. No one's going to take that as an excuse. So you just have to practice all the time. And any station I've ever been to is fully equipped with all the gear for you to train. So, you know, in your downtime, just be practicing all the time. That's really important.
I think that's a really good piece of advice. Even talking to some of the guys from the Free Radicals paramedic podcast, they said that to reduce the cognitive overload that can happen when you're on placement or as a, you know, graduate paramedic, one of the best ways to reduce that is just to get proficient and even just understand the logistics of what's in your bag, what's in the truck, what's in the kit, how to use the different pieces of equipment. So that way, when you are on a case, you've reduced some of that cognitive overload that, you know, is present. So,
absolutely. Yeah, and the muscle memory, I think, that comes with, you know, just putting so many IVs in, real people, obviously, so much different to a mannequin. And just absolutely knowing, making sure your kit's fully stocked, making sure you've got everything you need, having all those things that I've talked with you guys about, like emesis bags available, you know, your saline bags, and putting your IV kit together so that it's really easy for you to grab. Thinking, especially when you work by yourself, thinking about having your kit constructed so that you can get to everything really quickly and easily, with the least amount of fuss and time required.
Absolutely. And that definitely would translate into not only the rural but in the metro areas. But when you are rural, one of the pieces of information that was given to me is, like, you are the resource, like the community are relying on you as a paramedic. So how do you go about that, just to reduce that cognitive, I guess, burden or overload? Is it just like you said, just knowing and being proficient at all your skills and what you need to do?
Yeah, I think all those things. And one thing I would say, if you live and work in a community where you're known, is that the expectation of behaviour, so professional and personal, is huge. So, you know, just some tips of advice from me, not that I ever did this because I was well and truly, you know, a lot older, but for people who want to go out and, you know, go to the pub or go to the races or whatever, like, you're being judged the whole time, whether you're at work or not. And so I guess that's one of the other challenges of being in a place where you work and live, is that your behaviours are being watched all the time, whether you see people or not. You know, that might just be going past in the car, or, you know, you're identifiable all the time. So your professional behaviour needs to be appropriate at work and also in community. I'd also say that my husband and I spent a lot of time where we could have just sat in the station and watched, you know, binge. Well, back then it wasn't binge, it would be videos. you could binge, you know, all the shows and stuff. But biggest thing is spending the time and energy. Like, we were actually more busy with community work in rural and remote locations than we were when we were in metro areas, I've got to be honest. But we were really, you know, we really felt like we were part of the community, so we wanted to build trust, to have people know who we were. We did a lot of work with all the schools, so the kindies and the little preppies and, you know, the high schools and, you know, and also the primary school as well, daycare, you know, all of the groups, like the gymnastics group and the swimming team and all that kind of stuff. So I think engaging with the community is one of the most important things, because they will call you if they need you. We ended up probably doing a lot more of preventative stuff as well. So not just with all the kids and that kind of thing, but with older people. So there was the CWA, it was really big. So we would go and do some work with the CWA ladies. We'd do, I mean, I used to do all the first aid stuff around, not just in the towns that I was in, but sort of outlying towns as well. And lots of stuff about 000 for the little ones and, you know, just basic managing, because there's a lot of brown snakes in places like that. Everything bites and stings out there. And then, you know, what to do if, you know, dad's trapped underneath a quad bike and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of that kind of stuff. But then we'd also have families where there was, you know, domestic and family violence, all sorts of that sort of stuff. So we would work really closely with the police and the doctor and the nurses and the community nurses to see what we could do to prevent and alleviate a lot of that kind of stuff. So I think in small communities, the families will give you license to help out a little bit more than what you would ever expect to do. So I think there is a lot of, you know, the idea of community paramedicine is old and then becomes new again. But a lot of, you'll find a lot of rural and remote paramedics of my vintage or older will talk about all that stuff that they did without it being called community paramedicine. You're part of a professional team and you work as such. So the interprofessional team in those communities is just so important. Not only from an education and learning perspective, but also for support, because you go to the same cases. You know, if you've got, like I was talking about, the team that where they lost some of their kids, like that's felt, it might be the police officer's child, that might be their child goes to school with yours, you know, you might live and work and play with these people. So it's felt all the way through the community. And some of the places that I've worked, unfortunately we had young people suiciding, and possibly some of you people that are listening have heard about contagion. So you might have one person take their life, and then you might have a run of that. And that's certainly true in some regional towns. And it's so felt by the whole community. And there's a community grief as well as the family and individual grief that happens. And that's, I find that I felt that profoundly when we worked in those places. You can certainly feel like that for your patients and the people you go to in metropolitan areas, but I think it affects you differently when you, like I said, when you work and live and play with people.
For sure. That would be horrific to experience. And having that small town kind of community, you would generally have that close sense of community, like you said, and you may be treating someone that you know really well. How do you go about that and try and, I guess, not switch off from that, but, I don't know, distance yourself so that you're not, I guess, emotionally invested, but also able to provide, like, really great care?
Yeah, again, another great question. I'll just be really frank. I get very attached to people. And so, you know, I do feel those things. I guess having a, husband that's also, you know, sharing the load as well, I've always been able to talk with him and he with me. We probably just talk differently to each other about things like that. But I would just say the self-care perspective is really important in those communities. So, you know, you can give so much and you are at risk of giving so much that you give yourself away. So I think having that circle of support, so I talked about, you know, how you end up usually being quite good friends with police officers and nurses and doctors, and I think that's important. It's important to be able to talk about things. And so, you know, where I might have had a cry with one of my nursing colleagues in a small town, my husband might have, you know, had a beer after work, you know, when he's not on call on days off with, you know, the officer in charge of the police station, or they might have gone fishing together or have had a round of golf or something like that. So, you know, I might have been explicit about what was bothering me. My husband might have just gone around about it in a different way. They might have just said, hey, that job was pretty bad, wasn't it? Yeah, you okay, mate? Yeah, good. Yeah, how about you? Yeah, a bit bothered by it, but I'll be all right. And then they talk about golf or whatever. So I think to have that circle of support around you, your trusted people, is so important. Biggest thing in a small town is being confidential. So you'll always have people, you know, saying, oh, Jo, I heard you went to that case. You know, can you tell me about it or what happened? And, you know, I would just used to be really frank and say, oh, you know, thank you for asking. I'm so sorry. I just can't talk about the case. But I think they wrote something about it in the local paper, and that's probably a really good place to get some information. So I was just really honest about not being able to tell people about the ins and outs of things. But, you know, if it was on the public record, I might say, well, yeah, I saw that on the news, you know, when they reported that. And I think just all the usual self-care things you would do, whether you're in a rural and remote community or an urban community, just really taking time to look out for yourself, do the things that you like, recognise if something has rattled your cage, and I'm using that from Todd Weir and his team from the QAS peer support priority one, knowing what sorts of things really can upset you and recognising it. And, you know, if you've got some behaviours like you're agitated or anxious or not sleeping or you're recounting things that happened, that might be a bit of a light bulb moment to say, gosh, I'm wondering if I'm okay with this and I might need to chat to my trusted people. Or if it's something more than that and you don't want to divulge that to your trusted people, it might mean that you might need to talk with someone else, like a peer support priority one kind of person or counsellor or psychologist. Doesn't mean anything's wrong. It's really great to get some help just to chat about stuff. And, you know, because what we see is not what most people see usually, you know, see it all the time in different ways. And so we have to really make sense of what we see. It's not usual to see that. And we all pick this role. So important to know that it, you know, what we see isn't usual. And in order to make sense of it, sometimes we need to unpack that and all of us will have different ways of doing it. And I think that's the key thing, is having your own strategies and being able to work out what works for you. It's really important.
That really is. And I think it's kind of reassuring knowing, like, talking to a lot of different paramedics, they all say that they even have themselves have psychologists that they go and see, not necessarily because they have something wrong or anything like that, but just to be able to debrief and sort of work through what they see. Because like you said, it's not something that everyone would see on a daily basis for a job. Seeing all those little traumas like build up over time, it's not something that, you know, your friend may see if they're in a different profession.
Yeah, exactly. The worst that they might see is that someone messed up the books if they're an accountant and they go, oh, bugger, I've got to sort that out.
Exactly. And now that you're in a teaching role, one, what made you want to go into a teaching role? And two, what do you try to instill in your students now that you've had all this experience in the rural and metro environment as well?
I thought about that a lot and reflected on it. I think think I've always liked teaching. Pretty much started life pretty quickly after I qualified and started doing first aid courses and that kind of thing. Got to say that I wasn't really great at it. I was really nervous, and speaking to groups of people was not naturally a place of comfort for me. But I sort of looked at it in the way that, you know, I wasn't teaching math. I was teaching life-saving skills and helping people to normalise what would happen when they're doing that. So, you know, CPR and that kind of thing. And then I guess my early experiences of people providing education to me were not great when I first started as a paramedic. And then one day, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, he will die of embarrassment, but John Murray had been a high school teacher, I think, and he came into education in the ambulance service, and he just walked in and started talking. I was like, oh, he is inspirational. I would love to be like him. And he was so gentle and kind, clever, intuitive. It was just a natural thing, and I would never dare say that I'm anywhere like him, but I just, yeah, a light bulb moment for me came on. And so I ended up I was pregnant with my first child, and I got to be acting in a what they called a regional ambulance educator at South Brisbane, which is, I think, now a tunnel. I got to train honorees and casual staff while I was pregnant, and then I decided to start doing a master's in education. And I finished that, started doing clinical support officer work in a metro area in Brisbane, and then started doing it at Mount Isa, and then, you know, did lots and lots of different things. So I did some research assistant work for the Rural and Remote Paramedic Program, which was just a pilot program from a number of years ago between JCU and the Queensland Ambulance Service, and then ended up being regional manager for staff development in Townsville, and, you know, finished, well and truly finished when I was at Mornington Island. Actually, I think I finished my master's. Then one of the best things I ever did, I was the project manager for the Vulnerable Clients Program, which was a grant that the QAS got for $1 million. And we did some work in areas that typically ambulance service had never really touched before. So things like domestic and family violence, elder abuse, child abuse, intellectual developmental disability, mental health, a whole raft of things. So we did some education as a pilot program again in Brisbane, and then that was sent out across Queensland. But, you know, everything that's old is new again. So it got old for a while, and then people have sort of picked it up in different ways now. So just really proud of that. And that was the role I was doing just before I came to QT. So it was, 10, 11 years ago. And then coming into the tertiary sector was very different for me, because everyone, when I was RMSD, students were very, they were employees. And so if people didn't turn up for shift or didn't do their assignments or whatever, there was recourse for them, but they would be asked to leave the service, which very rarely happened, but there were lots of people, you know, that would get warnings and that kind of thing. And then it's completely different perspective at university, where students don't have to show up and they don't have to be diligent and they don't have to hand their stuff in and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, we went from groups of 20, 25 to cohorts of 200, 250. So it's quite a different experience for me. But again, up for the challenge and up for something new. It just was, just a different way of educating. It was enlightening and more professional growth and that kind of thing. And started meeting much younger students. That was another thing. So a lot of our students were much older in the service, and then at university, lots straight from school. So it's been great. And, in comparison, lots of opportunity for professional development here as well. So conference presentations internationally. So I've been to Geneva and China, Canada, Singapore, all sorts of places, flying the QT banner. Obviously, you don't just go for no reason. You have to put in an abstract and have that accepted and peer-reviewed. So that's been great. Then lots of people would think that we just teach, but that's one portion of what we do. So a lot of writing journal articles and, you know, applying for grants and providing guest lectures. We do a lot of work outside of the university as well. So perhaps with, you know, other ambulance services, I do a lot of work in the disability community. We're expected to be on boards and committees and that kind of thing. And then we also have our own PhD students and master students and all that kind of thing. So do a lot of guest lecturing. So I do some work with social work and education as well. So different faculties as well. So yeah, so it's quite, sometimes it can be all encompassing. So we're meant to work 37 and a quarter hours a week, I think it is, and it's more like 80 hours a week. but yeah, it's got its challenges, but I guess intellectual freedom and flexibility in the way that you can head down your research pathway. And mine is with vulnerable populations.
Definitely. And with that too, now you've done, obviously you seem like you've got a diverse range of, you know, opportunities that have come through with teaching as well. So from the student perspective, what do you try to teach them that they won't necessarily get out of a textbook or anything like that?
Yeah, lots of things. I think we all in different ways try and embed a lot of operational kind of knowledge. But I guess I try to think of what did I want to know all those years ago? And, you know, I've had a very different education because a lot of mine, you know, certainly in paramedics was a diploma-based education, but I have, you know, other degrees, clinical degrees and stuff like that. So a lot of it is just about things we probably can't teach but we need to immerse students into. So clinical judgment, problem solving, being a human being is the biggest thing that you can offer the people that you provide care to. And I say that genuinely, providing care, not, I don't even like to think of them as patients. They're people. They're our next door neighbours and the people that we work in with and love and, you know, are part of our community. So I like to call it providing care because that's what it is. I always think, hear a lot of things from students over the years, all different things. People come from very different places and that's okay because, you know, perspectives are so different. I think there's an assumption, I don't mean just here, I mean across all universities, that every student is a upper to middle class student who's got, you know, mum and dad and a dog and siblings and, you know, goes to private schools and hasn't had to work too hard and everything's been laid out for them. And I would suggest that that's absolutely not true. There's a proportion of people like that, but I like to think of paramedic students as being as diverse as the community that they serve. And so, you know, some of the stories my students have told me, I learn from their histories and their perspectives and their experiences. So I think being a human is the biggest part. And trying to make sure that students who are perhaps not as worldly as others understand that they're actually in the service of people, that you're going to see people at their lowest ebb on their worst day, at their worst moment. And it might not be, what would I say, to your liking. So there might be all the orifices are opening. So all the vomit, all the poo, all of this, all of that. They might be spitting, they might be swearing at you, they might come across as being violent and arrogant and awful, and perhaps they don't live the way that we all do or that some of us do or that we expect them to. But I always want students to be curious about, I wonder why that is. So So if this person's presenting in a particular way that isn't necessarily palatable to you, I wonder what's going on for that person, for them to behave that way or react that way or to live this way that I don't think doesn't meet my expectations. I wonder why they've called me for a paper cut. This is not what an emergency service is for, but I've had those, obviously, and I've had that discussion with a few students, like, that's just a waste of time. And I said, well, is it usual for someone to call for a paper cut? No, it's not. So I wonder what that is. And when you talk with someone, I wonder if they're lonely, if they actually don't know what to do with a paper cut because they feel hypersensitive to pain. And yes, they may be a computer programmer, but I wonder if cognitively they, have got something else going on. I wonder if they've called because there's domestic and family violence going on and it's a way to get access without saying, guess what, I've been beaten up by somebody. So there's lots of reasons why people will call for service. It may not meet with our ideas of what an emergency is, but it might be theirs, and we need to be listening to that. So I guess the type of paramedic I really appreciate, whether they're a novice practitioner or someone that's been around for a very long time, are those that can show great empathy, and that can be in very different ways. It doesn't have to be, I don't mean hugging your patient and bringing them home and saying, look, I've got a spare room. I'm talking about listening, being humble, not going in as the expert, listening to the person's stories and hearing their perspective and what's going on for them, acknowledging that people live differently, people have different perspectives. People have had some really hard lives and they might just tell you a small snippet of what's going on. They might tell you the whole life story, or they might be really, they might tell you nothing. And so we need to not just listen, but also sense things and ask, appropriate, thoughtful questions that respect the person. Everyone hears me all the time talking about the Australian Charter of Health Rights, but I think if you had that just somewhere where you're always, looking at that, or you have it on your phone as a photo, you can't go wrong if you look at those, the virtues really, about being respectful to people, about listening to them, about at their way of, their cognitive ability, being able to share information with them and have them in shared decision making. And to help them be part of what's going on. And if they want their family member or their, whoever's close to them to be part of that as well. I think that's really important. And I think certainly from my perspective, when I've worked with novice practitioners, comes with time and you can't necessarily know all that stuff, but being open to all those things, knowing that you're going to make mistakes is another thing. Like I say, particularly at uni, to students, make mistakes here. It's safe. It's safe to do it. It's not safe to do it on a patient or a person that you're providing care to. So, the university experience is really important to learn and make mistakes and not beat yourself up. And then when you're out on clinical placement, learning, putting all that together, watching and absorbing, it's the best thing you can do. What's going on? Like, watch your mentors, especially, and you all know what a mentor looks like that is able to offer you opportunity to learn. And sometimes we have mentors that we learn from and we go, I'll never do that. Would never do that. When I'm finished, I won't do that. I won't even do that now. So I think they're the main things: being humble, open, approachable, empathetic. Being curious is about the best quality you can have, really important in that practice. And if you don't like people, don't be paranoid. Just don't, because sometimes people aren't very likable, but sometimes we aren't either.
100%. No, that's a really amazing insight. I really love that one about being curious. And hopefully, like all of our listeners, will take that on board as well for placement and things like that, because you do hear it a lot, and I'm sure you've heard it a lot, is when students sort of describe a rubbish case, like you were saying, like, oh, the paper cut, but why is that going on? That's really amazing. And definitely take that on board. So I'm mindful of your time. So I'd like to go through the last three questions, which are the three questions that we ask everyone, just so students can get a different perspective. So the first one is, what is your biggest mistake that's resulted in your greatest learning?
So I did mention this sort of more recently. I remember being brand new. I think it was first week on the job. And this person had gone through, they were in a car and they were driving. They went through an intersection and cleaned up a few cars and stuff. And the person was unconscious when we got to them. And this person was trying to tell me, give me a history of what was going on. And I just disregarded them the whole time, just didn't want to listen to them. I was very focused on the patient, and the patient was having difficulty breathing, unconscious, all that sort of stuff. And after a while, this person just said, you need to listen to me. And I remember my mentor saying, look, I've got this. How about you listen to this person? And he was trying to tell me that the person was unconscious before they actually went through the intersection. And I've never forgotten that. Well, after that, I listened to everyone. Sometimes I might need to concentrate on the patient, person, and also say to that bystander, whomever they are, whether they're clinically, you know, a clinical person or not, could you just give me a second? I really want you to tell me what's going on, or the information you've got. Can you just wait for a minute? Or they might say, look, this is really important, so I'll get my partner to look after the patient and then listen to them. And I always, always listen to bystanders or whoever they are. And they may really fill in some blanks for all of us. So whether it's they've witnessed something, whether, you know, someone's taken an overdose and they've got all the packets there and they know how many were in the pack and how many they've taken and when they took them and all that kind of stuff. It might be someone who's on the phone trying to tell us about their elderly mother that they haven't seen for a long time. And saying, I always call her at 8 a.m. She hasn't been answering the phone and it's now 8:30 and I'm really worried. So that's one of the main things I would say is I've made so many mistakes, but that's one of them.
That's a really good one. I really like that one. And I think that was also in social media last week about paramedics actually saying, listen to the bystanders, because, for example, some of them might be paramedics as well, and you never know, and or medically trained, and they can provide such great insight that you just dismiss otherwise.
100%. They could be a paramedic. They also could be a neurosurgeon. You're going to their mum who's had a stroke. You know, let's think about this.
For sure. And then
they also could be someone that just needs to be heard.
Exactly. Like you said, be human, treating humans.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love that one. So the second one is, and we've probably touched on it, is just one piece of advice, one simple piece of advice that you would give to a student.
Be humble and don't get involved in any politics whatsoever, but be really humble. You can't know everything. Even if you've been practicing for 60 years, you can't know everything. And so be that person that's willing. So, for example, if a mentor or someone wants to show you something, say take a blood pressure, and you think you're pretty competent at it, be humble and gracious enough to go, thank you, I'd really like to see that, because they might just show you one little tip that you've never thought of before. And that will be appreciated because they want to show you, they want to help you. And with everything, just be a humble person. It's one thing that will earn the respect of your peers and mentors and colleagues.
And then the last one, it's a bit of a tongue twister, but is, what did you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
I think I've just firmed up my belief that nothing is black and white. I used to kind of not think black and white, but quite heavy shades of, you know, black, dark grey, pure white, not too much. And now I just see everything in shades of grey. But everything is just, I think everyone has their own reality. Everyone has their own perspective. And we need to be mindful of that. So it just really isn't proper right or wrong. I think it's, yeah. And as paramedics, we really need to be focusing on so many things and so many perspectives. And our perspective and our understanding isn't necessarily right. So be open to what other people will offer. And I hope that you see things, all of you see things in great shades of grey down the track.
That's really good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to have a chat. Hopefully all of our listeners who are considering going and working rural or are unsure about it or haven't even thought about it have learnt something and, you know, really do consider doing it. So thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.